Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Turbo Time Podcast. I'm your host, James Cook, the Associate Editor of Turbo Machinery International. For this episode, we'll be talking to the Mythbusters, Klaus Bruhn and Rainer Kurz, about the recent developments in centrifugal compressors.
All right. Today we're going to be talking a little bit more about centrifugal compressors. We've covered that subject in the past quite a bit, but there's certainly a lot to cover. Today we're going to really look at centrifugal compressors, recent developments, some of the things to consider about centrifugal compressors, what's new, what has been done over the last couple of years, and really where are we going industry-wise with centrifugal compressors. So more of the general topic. And I'd really like to start maybe talking a little bit about history. And I looked it up, but centrifugal compressors have effectively been around for at least 130 years or so. People are talking about Stodola and Curtiss and others of the pioneers of the turbo machinery industry that have apparently worked on centrifugal compressors in the 1890s or so. There were patents on centrifugal compressors before that, but I'd like to kind of start talking about, what is a centrifugal compressor? How do they function? What do they do? And so I'll hand it over to you, Rainer, and maybe you can talk a little bit about what does a centrifugal compressor do, and then I'll jump back in.
Okay, thanks, Klaus. I mean, the purpose of any compressor is essentially to increase the pressure of a gas. And so we find axial compressors where the flow is mostly in the direction of the shaft of the machine. That's why they're called axial. And in a centrifugal compressor, we have essentially the flow coming into the impeller in an axial direction and leaving it in a roughly radial direction. And aerodynamically, that actually allows you to increase to have much more pressure ratio per stage than in an axial machine. The other th and in a way, it's actually easier to build aerodynamically a functional centrifugal compressor than an axial compressor. That's actually why they were very early on very successful. Just like in any compressor, you have actually a rotating piece, the impeller, that imparts all the energy into the gas. And then after that, you have a diffuser that converts the kinetic energy part of the gas into more pressure. So it's again just like with an axial compressor, a two-stage process.
Yeah, and there's multiple stages in each compressor. Some of them are single stage, but the majority of them are multi-stage. So each stage adds a little bit of pressure, and that's basically the same that happens in an axial compressor, right? I mean, you add the angular momentum per stage, so you're really adding work and energy, and really in a tangential direction as kinetic energy, and then you're converting that kinetic energy back to what I'd call potential energy in the form of pressure in the diffuser section of the compressor. And you kind of mentioned there's axial and then there's centrifugals, and they're really also on the low the pressure ratio side. We'll talk about blowers, and it's really probably incorrect to call them compressors because you really don't have a density change in those machines, but a lot of people kind of throw them into that same classification. There's also other types of compressors, and we're probably not going to talk too much about, but there's reciprocating compressors and diaphragm compressors and so on. Can you, Rainer, at least from your perspective, what's the advantage of a centrifugal and an axial compressor versus a recip compressor, but also between a centrifugal and axial? You kind of sort of mentioned both of those. So can you talk about that a little bit? What are the application advantages, disadvantages, where you would use them, for what kind of application, where they make sense, and so on.
Yeah, in very broad terms, depending on how much flow you have to manage, and when I'm talking about flow, it's not the mass flow, but the volumetric flow. For relatively low flows, the reciprocating compressors have advantages. Then, if you go to higher flows, you will go into centrifugal compressors. And if you go to very high flows, will use axial compressors. In the centrifugal compressor, obviously the method to increase the pressure is simply you lock in a certain amount of gas, and then you reduce the volume, therefore increasing the pressure by moving your piston. In a centrifugal and axial compressor, it's a dynamic system where you essentially change the direction of your working fluid in a rotating frame, and then convert the excess kinetic energy back into pressure. And again, that works much better for high flows than for low flows. And if you have to go to very high flow, you will go to an axial compressor. The pressure ratio per casing is often limited simply by acceptable temperature limits, and these are essentially the same for reciprocating compressors and for centrifugal and axial compressors.
Yeah. And we see that. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about which compressor is better for hydrogen and CO2 and all that kind of stuff. At the end of the day, they all work. If you're really looking at low volume flows, recips will work fine. And if you need a lot of pressure ratio per stage, you're sometimes better off with a recip compressor. But then you're usually flow limited because you can only make a cylinder to a certain size before it becomes unreasonably large and gigantic.
Yes.
Whereas on a centrifugal, you get a lot of head per stage because you have a high tip speed because you're going out in the radial direction. And axial, because the flow path is pretty much straight through, you can handle a lot of flow. But that kind of brings up a little bit what I wanted to talk about, which is development in the last 50 years. And I think there's a lot of confusion where centrifugals versus axials, where the line is. If you look at the old textbooks in our industry, there is, all of them, every single one, including the ones you and I have put together, there is a table in there that kind of shows, for this kind of pressure ratio or discharge pressure or head versus flow, you should be using this type of compressor. And it usually shows on the low flow side, it shows the recips. And then on the high flow side, it shows the axials, but it doesn't give you that much pressure ratio. And then it shows like centrifugals in the middle and integrally geared also in the middle. And I think one of the problems we're seeing now in the industry is that over the last 40, 50 years, the aerodynamics have improved so much that a lot of the applications where you would traditionally say this should be an axial machine, you can squeeze that into a centrifugal machine now because we used to only be able to get to flow coefficients of maybe 0.15, 0.16, and then we'd become nervous about how much flow you can squeeze through that machine. And now, if you look at high flow impellers in centrifugal machines, you can go up to 0.25 and maybe even up to 0.3 for some of these mixed flow impellers. And at least in my opinion, and I'd like to hear your opinion on this, Rainer, too, but in my opinion, whenever you can squeeze a centrifugal compressor into an application, you're much better off with a centrifugal rather than with an axial. And that's just for basic mechanical reasons. An axial is what we call a bladed machine, basically a disc with mounted blades on it. So you end up with lots and lots of blades, and so you end up with a lot more pieces than with a centrifugal machine. And so centrifugal compressors tend to be more rugged. And so my opinion, and I don't know if you agree with that, but I'd like to hear your opinion on this, is my opinion, if you can squeeze it into a centrifugal somehow, then you should go with a centrifugal versus an axial. And obviously, there are exceptions to that.
Yeah, and I mean, the part of the issue is that if you think about where centrifugal compressors came from, they were essentially pieces of blade welded on a disc, and then and another shroud welded on top of it. So aerodynamically, this was initially not terribly sophisticated, but that was back then. Today, we have the capability to design highly sculpted three-dimensional airfoils into our centrifugal compressors that have helped to both push the efficiency of that we see on these machines to very high level, but also have allowed to effectively manage manage very high flows without having a lot of separation in the flow path. So yes, the capability to go to very high flow coefficients, flow coefficients basically the flow related to the tip speed of the impeller and the and a flow area. That capability is to a large part due to the fact that we have aerodynamic tools where we can actually very precisely calculate and manage these highly three-dimensional flows. And that was originally the advantage of an axial compressor, that you could, with two-dimensional flow tools, you could get very far. But even with axial compressors today, these blades are highly three-dimensional, highly sculpted.
Yeah. And I mean, I just get frustrated sometimes because I get the engineers come to me and say, hey, this is an axial compressor application. And I look at it and it's easily handled by a centrifugal compressor for a process gas application. Now, for air, I kind of tend to agree because of, you don't really have to worry about sealing that much. You don't really need to worry about, you can do these Laby seals. You don't have to worry about dry gas seals or anything beyond that. It makes sense to use axial compressors in many applications. But for a lot of process applications where people think, oh, this should be an axial, it really can be done with one. And even if it's sometimes with two centrifugals in parallel, you're sometimes still commercially better off because centrifugals tend to be much more reliable than axial compressors, have fewer parts and components. And then the operating range, obviously, on an axial compressor is much more limited than that of a centrifugal compressor, although that changes also once you get into mixed flow kind of stages.
And we really need to clarify one thing. Yes, if you have a low pressure applications where you basically take air at ambient pressure and bring it to a higher pressure, that's one thing. But where centrifugal compressors in particular have a lot of advantages is if you go to higher pressures. And higher pressure does not necessarily mean thousands of pounds, but pressures where the gas forces on the aerodynamic components become significant. Because there, the very design of a centrifugal impeller with relatively short blades, and relative is really relative, but you get a far more rugged design than if you have to deal with an axial compressor.
Yeah, there have been tremendous developments on the aerodynamic side where we went really from what we used to call 2D impellers, what you kind of say, basically things just straight blades welded together or even riveted together at some point in time, where we've now moved to fairly complex three-dimensional shapes, often five-axis machine cast, precision cast. Much more complicated aerodynamic shapes that are possible nowadays. There have been a lot of other developments, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit on the centrifugal compressor side. I mean, we've seen magnetic bearings coming on, we've seen gas bearings, we've seen dry gas seals really replace the wet seals that we saw 30, 40 years ago. That's been, basically a complete replacement. What do you see are the kind of the biggest movements as far as new technologies in the centrifugal compressor industries that either those that I mentioned or anything else that you see?
Well, actually, there is one trend that's very interesting, and that is that the computational fluid dynamics that used to be sort of the thing that the aerodynamicists worked for, there is now a lot of interaction between being able to do these calculations both for the aerodynamic flow path, but also for the interaction between rotor dynamics and aerodynamics, that really has allowed us to run machines in a predictably stable fashion at higher and higher pressures and with longer rotors. I've mentioned the capability of doing very complex shapes of the blades and actually predicting their performance very well. I mean that is actually one of the things that the reliability of predicting performance has and that's by the way true both for rotodynamics and for aerodynamics has tremendously increased. So that really helps for the applications of machines where you essentially do not build hundreds of exactly the same. You use design methodologies, but essentially you adapt the machine very carefully to some given process conditions, and they may be different from pro they are almost certainly different from project to project. The new things, one of the things that really created a lot of very exciting challenges was the introduction of hydrogen on the one end of the spectrum and the importance of compressing CO2 for very high pressure ratios on the other end of the spectrum. And while CO2 compression is to a large degree a game where you have to be able to deal with relatively high Mach numbers, potentially transonic flow in your machines, on hydrogen, it's all about how high can we push the tip speed to get more pressure ratio out of the machines. And so now all of a sudden you talk about open-faced impellers in multi-stage machines. You talk about new materials that have not been used to manage these high tip velocities. So that very occurrence really is pushing a lot of the compressor designs into new areas. And we probably at some point in time we'll talk about not just aerodynamics and rotodynamics, but also about looking into the materials of constructions that we use for these machines.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, when you look at hydrogen, you have these really, really high speed impellers. It comes down to weight, to force ratios, right? And weight to speed ratio. And so basically, you want either light materials that don't give you a lot of hoop stresses, or you want very, very strong materials. But most of the strong materials tend to be not so good for hydrogen and the hydrogen embrittlement side, titanium being a problem. So we're seeing a lot of discussion about aluminum alloys because they tend to be good for hydrogen and they're also very, very light. And also because they're relatively easy from a fabrication perspective, we're seeing that. The other thing that is interesting is especially when you look at some of these process gases like hydrogen, there's a big discussion in the industry, do we go hermetically sealed machine, right? Or do we go with something like a conventional machine with a dry gas seal, where you basically have a separate driver that could be using magnetic bearings or not? I mean, if you use an electric motor, if you use a gas turbine, you certainly want to go that direction. But on the other hand, you have, especially out of Europe, you see a lot of this pushing for hydrogen using a hermetically sealed machine where you don't have to worry about any leakages at all because you don't really have any casing penetrations with your shaft and your motors inside of the medical enclosure. My opinion on those is that hermetically sealed machines look kind of neat because they seem to be simpler as far as, okay, yeah, I have my motor on the inside. I don't have to worry about dry gas seals. But then when you really look into it at more detail, what you find is that because of your windage losses and your recirculation that you need to keep the motor cool, that you end up with a substantial efficiency loss in these machines versus something a lot simpler, which is basically a centrifugal compressor. And you can use magnetic bearings either way if your driver is on magnetic bearings. But that's kind of sort of an interesting discussion. And I'd like to see what you say about that, Rainer.
Yeah, I mean the one of the problems that hydrogen gets you into any types of magnetic bearings or integrated motors is fundamentally that there are a lot of materials that are very attractive on the electric side, don't really play well with hydrogen. One of the prime examples is neodymium for permanent magnets, for example. The issue with integrated machines or hermetically sealed machines and more conventional machines actually spans the whole area of compression, because there are machines that for example hermetically machines that compress CO2 or that compress natural gas. But actually the interesting thing is that the penetration of these machines into the market was and is very slow, because as Klaus mentioned, there are a number of technical challenges that arise from having to essentially operate an electric motor in, especially with CO2 and also with natural gas at higher pressure in a very relatively dense fluid, so you create a lot of friction losses there.
And I mean, the other thing I didn't mention is also that obviously you're power limited, right? Because you're going to have a high speed motor, because you're not going to have a gearbox inside of your hermetic enclosure. And so that means you're limited as far as the size, because as far as electric motors are concerned, when you get into the high speed motors, there is not a lot of experience out there with machines over, say, 15 megawatts or even less than that. I would even say 12, 13 megawatts. That's when you kind of run into limits. And I agree. I mean, we see hermetically sealed machines, obviously for subsea applications, right? That makes perfect sense. That's really the only option that you have in that particular case. But for other applications, you see in Europe some, but they don't really see them in the rest of the world. Most operators prefer to just have a conventional centrifugal compressor driven by an electric motor with or without a gearbox. And some of them do go the magnetic bearing route, although that's relatively rare too. Most people live with fluid film bearings because there's really fundamentally nothing wrong with them. And they live with dry gas seals because there's fundamentally nothing wrong with them. And the leakage rate that you get out of dry gas seals nowadays, it's so low that it's hard to consider that a real problem when compared to other sources of process gas leakage in the industry through valves, through flaring and other sources. So that's not, in my opinion, a significant problem. How about on the system side? I mean, we haven't really done much on the surge and on the choke side. Everybody is like, okay, I want the highest efficiency in a compressor, right? And so you do your aerodynamics, you optimize the machine for a single point. But then do machines really operate on a single operating point when they're in a compressor station or somewhere?
Well, I mean, again, it depends a bit on the application. Certainly in process plants, the operating conditions are probably reasonably well defined. If you operate a machine in a pipeline or in an offshore field where you will see large swings in operating conditions, both on a hourly basis, if you will, but also on a seasonal or basis or over the years. And so Klaus is absolutely right. There are many compressors that never even really operate at their design point. And that is indeed one of the areas where the capability to predict the performance of a machine, not just at the design point, but also be able to more and more precisely predict the performance of a machine on the extreme operating points, meaning near the aerodynamic stability limits or in choke limits, really has helped to push the operating range, which in many applications is far more valuable than squeezing another point in efficiency out of the machine. And again, we mentioned also earlier that is one of the distinctive features between a centrifugal machine and potentially an axial machine for given operating conditions. But there are also other things. Actually, managing these extreme operating points is not just an aerodynamic issue, it's also a controls issue. Meaning improvements in the capability of control systems to, first of all, predict the dynamic operation of the system, and to precisely manage the machines and the process to, first of all, operating as efficient as possible and operating also over a wide operating range, there have been huge improvements over the last few years.
Yeah, and that's really a system design issue. And I still see a lot of machines where you have a trip, an emergency shutdown, and the machine goes immediately into a transient search situation, and that could have been avoided if they'd done a dynamic analysis. Dynamic analysis has really come along in the last 20, 30 years, where you can reasonably accurately predict how your machine's going to behave in a dynamic upset situation. It's also that the control systems have become better. I mean, it's not just a linear search line and a control line. I mean, your real control line should be set along with, where do you risk getting the machine into search if there is a trip, right? It shouldn't be an arbitrary 10% search margin offset from where you think the search line is, and you don't really know where the search line is most of the time anyway. So I think the industry has come a long way, but I think that's an area where there is still significant improvement because I see. And it's not just transient search, but I'm also seeing reverse flow situations where reverse rotation situation where basically machines, when they trip, every time they go into reverse rotation up to, up to their maximum continuous speed, which is not very good for the machine. But we see these kind of situations, and so there is still from a system design where maybe the industry needs to learn more how to do transient search analysis or transient dynamic analysis, and then design control systems and recycle systems and hot gas bypass systems if needed to make sure that your machine has the operating range that you need and want and stays reasonably efficient. And then I also have to say that sometimes, I mean, recycle is not always the worst thing, right? I mean, there are situations where it may be okay to recycle a little bit. If that gives you the operating range that you want.
Yeah, I mean the general trend to let's say when Klaus and I started in this industry, it was basically some process designer would throw two or three operating conditions across the fence, and you would design a compressor for that without really particularly getting too much input about what that process really does. You had your operating points, you designed for it. The trend is to more and more see this as a system that consists of a compressor and piping and process demands and optimize for that. Now probably the area where you see a lot of integration even today is, for example, on pipelines, where it's become fairly routine to do that. But you also see that in a lot of other applications, offshore, onshore, in plants, where you essentially look into the overall system and essentially integrate the machine performance and the process performance to optimize the outcome.
Yeah, there's still ways to go as far as machine integration into the system where there's room for improvement. You kind of said it, when you and I started in the industry, giving away a little bit of our age, and things have changed over the last 20, 30 years or so quite a bit. But that actually brings up an interesting point because now we're seeing AI, we're seeing alternative energy, sustainable energy. And I see a lot of young engineers being scared of getting into our industry because they're saying, oh, well, you don't need turbo machinery engineers anymore because everything's going to be solid state electricity with photovoltaics and you really don't need gas turbines anymore. You don't need compressors. And at least from what I've seen over the last 10 years or so is it's actually gotten worse for us, right? There's more applications for turbo machinery engineers. We have to now deal with hydrogen. We have to deal with CO2. We have to deal with ammonia, with all these fluids that are critical parts of a decarbonized energy industry that we need to develop turbo machinery for that we really haven't, right? I mean, if you look at the legacy of our compression, it comes a lot out of the chemical industry, out of the refinery industry from the 1920s or so, and then the pipeliners came on a little later. replacing a lot of the recent machinery, and then it get broader and broader. And now we're looking at this entire new field. You kind of talked about, hydrogen is on one extreme, the lightest of all gases, and CO2 is a very heavy, high mole weight gas. And we really don't have all the turbo machinery answers for all of that yet. Yes, we have machines that kind of sort of work, but they're far from optimized at this point in time.
Yeah, and I mean, for a young engineer, you really have to understand that one of the things that AI really does, it allows you to not have to deal with the stupid stuff, finding drawings, finding literature, finding or filling out forms. There's a lot of stuff that AI does that keeps you as an as a practicing engineer from the stuff that you really went to college for. Now, of course, that also changes some of the or essentially in on the education side, you have to teach young engineers to understand to understand the, for example, the flow structures, to understand the rotodynamic principles, but that's not going to go away. In fact, actually, that's probably going to be far more important than it is today.
Yeah, we see. I mean, I think understanding the physics of the processes is far more important now than it was. And it reminds me a little bit of, 30 years ago when people were talking about computational fluid dynamics and even finite element analysis, how that's going to take everybody's job away. And what it really did is it shifted the job description from, doing hand calculations for aerodynamics using velocity vector diagrams and Euler equation to becoming sophisticated operators of computational fluid dynamics. And so AI is another very valuable tool that's going to simplify process, hopefully make us better, give us better machines, but it's not going to take away the turbo machinery design or engineer. And if anything, it's going to require a deeper understanding of how machines work, because AI does act a little bit like a black box, and sometimes you really need to understand why something came out of it. Does it really make sense or not? Just the same way as CFD has kind of evolved over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I mean, just to illustrate this thing, AI is fantastic if you, for example, have to get the reference list on your paper from one format into another one. That it used to be very painful. It's now just a push of a button, you're done. On the other hand, try to have AI write a technical paper for you. You will realize that it has very well formulated sentences and it sort of flows very smooth, except that a lot of stuff is plain wrong. So as I said, as a young engineer, I actually would be rather enthusiastic about the fact about all the mundane stuff that I don't have to do because I have AI and that I'm more that I can focus better on the really interesting stuff and the really important stuff and the stuff that you actually go to college for. Because you don't go to college to fill out forms.
Yeah. With that said, that means we still have a little bit of a future in our industry, Rainer and I, and hopefully another couple of generations of turbo machinery engineers. I think we're running out of time here. It's been, as always,
Yeah.
a fantastic discussion, Rainer. Appreciate talking to you, and appreciate the audience putting up with us another time. Looking forward to another discussion with you, Rainer.
Yeah, again, thanks, Klaus. This is really enjoyable. So thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us this episode. Also, a big thanks to our audience for tuning in. Again, I'm your host, James Cook, and we'll see you next time.